listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Now, while the practice of self-care is most often touted for its profound mind, body, and spiritual benefits, today's guest shows how self-care can also be a powerful tool for spurring transformative collective action. Perhaps finding true health and peace is not a solo endeavor. Our guest today is Shelley Tegelsky, author of the new book, Sit Down to Rise Up, How Radical Self-Care Can Change the World. Shelley is the founder of the global grassroots mutual aid organization, Pandemic of Love. She's also co-founder of Partners in Kind, a purpose and production equity fund that invests in social impact and entertainment projects. Her work as a self-care activist, community organizer, and mindfulness teacher has been featured by over 100 media outlets, including CNN Heroes, The Kelly Clarkson Show, CBS This Morning, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. What an illustrious list. A trauma-informed mindfulness teacher and former Garrison Institute fellow, she's been called one of the 12 most powerful women in the mindfulness movement by mindful.org. Shelley's currently working on her doctorate degree at the Lilly School of Philanthropy at Indiana University. Well, hello, Shelley, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Now, I'm going to start out with Chelsea Handler's description of your book, which is in the preface to your book. And she says, this book is a blueprint for personal growth and effective societal contribution. It's a roadmap to compassion, radical self-care, what it means to be part of a community, and what it means to give and receive love. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, I certainly never thought, to be honest with you, that I would write a book. I think there's a lot of people who think, wow, I have so much to say and I want to, make sure that I codify it in some way. I was actually approached by Mindful Magazine at the time, which was I'm not sure if it's still a print publication or not, but Mindful Magazine approached me about doing a series called Self-Care for Activists, or Self-Care in Politically Charged Times, I think is what they ended up calling it. And this was, close to the 2020 elections. And I took the time to write a series for the magazine and got a really incredible response to that series. And that really served as a cornerstone. And I thought, I wonder if I can sort of, build upon this body of work now, these six articles that I originally wrote, and make it so that it's not just for politically charged times, although certainly we are living in politically charged times still, but actually, make it so that it is relevant for all times. Okay. Because even, if somebody's going through a difficult time in their own life, and certainly we all do at key points in our life, how do we really understand how to take care of ourselves, take care of others, build community, weave safety nets? And yes, also to lean on something that Audre Lorde, once said, use self-care as an act even of resistance when needed.
You have developed a wonderful intersection between self-care and community, and this book totally speaks to that and so much more. There's so much value and different kinds of value in this book. I'm afraid to ask who it was written for, because it's like, I think everybody should read it. So anyway, thank you for that. Now, you write, quote, I am the type of person who tends to thrive in spaces where others might shrink, cave, or fall apart. And the stories you tell in the book really illustrate that so well. You say, I need a certain measure of chaos surrounding me in order to take the initiative. Okay, well, not everyone is like that. And how relevant is your advice for people who are not as initiatory as yourself?
Yeah, I think my advice is still incredibly relevant, because the point of community, and really when the way that I define communal care, is really steeped in the tenets of mutual aid. And the premise of mutual aid is that a community requires all sorts of people, that it inherently believes and is built upon a notion that every single human being on this planet has something that they can contribute, regardless of their socioeconomic status. And every single person on this planet has something they need, also regardless of their socioeconomic status. And so the idea is that we can build community using the strength of different people, using what they can contribute, right? Some people may have money, but some people may have time poverty. Some people may have extra time. Some people may have space and energy to be able to do something, or a very unique or specific skill. And so the idea is that when we think about self-care, and this is why it's incredibly important to kind of make sure that we just first like return to the roots of like the terminology of self-care. Many people think of self-care as an individualistic pursuit. And I understand why, because the word self is in there, right?
Right,
and so
right.
They think it's the me, the I. And in fact, what the book really aims to do is, yes, carry you through that journey of me, because we have to be able to put that oxygen mask on ourselves first so that we can help others, but really carry us through from the me to the we to the us. And the notion that the reason that we are putting that oxygen mask on first on ourselves, the reason that we invest in the individualistic component of self-care, is so that we can show up for others. And so that in turn, they can show up for us and we can build those safety nets that make it then in turn much easier to administer self-care.
Right. And one of the things that derails people in our society is this obsession with the pursuit of success, the pursuit of happiness. And you have a lot to say about that. And you quote Viktor Frankl, who wrote The Search for Meaning. What an incredible book. And he says, don't aim at success. The more you aim at it, the more you're going to miss it, because it cannot be pursued like happiness. It must ensue. And if it only does as an unintended side effect of one's personal dedication to a cause greater than oneself, or as the byproduct of one's surrender to a person other than oneself. And then you go on to write, the odds of reaching a level of relative happiness and fulfillment favor those with a defined purpose and meaning. That's very profound. Can you speak to that?
Sure. I think that, you know, and I had to learn this the hard way. And I think there's so many books and really wonderful books and people who speak about their journeys, which are not dissimilar to mine, in the sense that, like, when we're chasing a goal, you know, when we're climbing this proverbial mountain and we reach the mountaintop eventually, if we do, we come up empty. Like, it's if the only pursuit of our life is to, you know, reach that mountaintop, that is actually setting ourselves up for failure. If the goal is really steep, if our kind of journey instead is steeped, and I talk a lot about this in the book, in intention, centering our life around intentions instead of goals, it completely reframes things in a way that really helps to connect us to the realization of those intentions in a very, you know, tangible way. So for example, when we talk about these abstract terms that I think have been hijacked and co-opted, and certainly, you know, capitalism has taken them and created an industry out of terms like happiness and peace and balance and harmony and all these things that you see printed on shirts now and little stones and coffee mugs and whatever. You know, those terms, like, if they evade people, they're confusing to so many people because we see them as goals versus
Right.
how do I center every single thing that I do in my life around this particular intention?
Okay, so let's
And
talk
that
about
really
it.
creates the purpose.
Intention is an interesting term, and to substitute intention for goals is an interesting concept because intentions seem kind of dicey to me. You know, they say the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So tell us about what do you mean by intention? Is that a sense of purpose, you know, expressing itself? Okay.
Yeah, but I think it forces us to get a little bit more specific. So one of the practices that I talk about in the book is something that I call if only for today. And this is a practice that I've been using for many, many years, where when I wake up every morning, I think to myself, what is the intention?
Right.
What is this intention word, right? As abstract as it may be, that I want to infuse in my life today,
right.
just for today, right? And it could be the same word. You can replace day with year if you're a resolution type of person, you know, that's fine. But if we really kind of sit and think about, like, if I showed up more with this type of quality, right? And so we can substitute the word intention for like quality of being, right?
Okay.
If I showed up more and I was more patient, if I showed up and I was kinder, if I had more compassion today, what would that change in the way that I'm showing up in the world?
So does your, and you do this practice every morning, and I was going to bring that up because I think it's a great sadhana, as they say in the yogic universe, spiritual practice to start the day with. I'm just curious, does your intention change, the intention you want to focus on change every day or very much?
You know, it's interesting. It's so funny. Like it's the ebb and flows of life sort of, especially if you're not meditating or ruminating on specifically what that word is, and you just let it kind of pop into your head or like wash over you, you know, in a brief moment, and you don't like question it. There have been times where I had the same word for, you know, weeks and weeks and months.
Right.
So when I was going through a really challenging time, and still working very much in the corporate world and having panic attacks and really questioning like the worth of my life after reaching a goal, right, of like running a company and being successful financially and all of these, getting all these accolades and recognitions, et cetera, but yet being the most miserable I'd ever been in my life, I started to ask myself this question. And the intention that kept coming up for me during that time was community and connection, community
right.
and connection, you know, so they would alternate. And so when I started to think about, okay, well, how do I center my life around the need for community or to commune with people? How do I build community? What do I need to do on a daily basis in order to be able to center the way that I'm operating in this world that is very individualistic and driven by capitalism and like this fiduciary responsibility that I have to the company that I'm working for at the time? What does that look like? And for me, what that looked like was I'm going to first and foremost connect with myself. I'm going to commit to meditating, you know, every Sunday morning in a peaceful way. At the time, I was living in South Florida at the beach. And then expand that terminology of community and connection to inviting other people to join me.
Right. It's an incredible story. The way that you have manifested community in your life, but also for the sake of the community, the collective itself, is really some really great stories in the book that I really enjoyed a lot. And, you know, you stress the importance and power of showing up. And I think that's the title of the book. And, you know, so why is showing up so difficult for many people?
I think we succumb to the voices in our heads. You know, we think that we don't have the the right tools, or we don't have the right pedigree, or we don't have the right access or ability to show up. We question ourselves. We question the ability to just simply love and be kind. And those are the two things that are the most inherent to just being human, right? Having empathy. And so if we could just believe and trust in this beautiful gift that we have as human beings, the gift of being able to be empathetic and to connect with people on that level, and let that just be our guide, I think it becomes a lot more easier to, you know, more easy to show up.
You know, I want to talk about mutual aid and the community of care, but first, it seems to me one of the obstacles for a lot of people is their resistance to asking for help. And you have a lot to say about that. And you say asking for help requires us to be resourceful, a key element of emotional strength. And I thought that was a really, really great concept that not very many people have thought of. So asking for help is pretty important, right? And that blocks people because, you know, they think, oh, I'm going to be part of a community so I can contribute, but they have needs. Everybody has needs. Why is asking for help so important? What would you say?
I think that asking for help, you know, if we want to think about it it's interesting to think about it and frame it in a way of like, how do I invite other people to ask for help too?
Right.
When we normalize asking for help, when we're able to be brave enough and courageous enough to say, these are my needs, I'm willing to be vulnerable and express that I need help with these things.
Right.
It actually signals to others in community that it's okay and it's a safe space to be able to do the same. I think that, again, we go back to this individualistic society that we have grown into. And the reality is that when we think about every single element of and every single thing that we have accomplished or that we do on a daily basis or that we consume on a daily basis, it's even if we're doing that thing alone, there are still like hundreds, if not thousands of people, and generationally thousands of people who have contributed to that thing that we're eating or that we're driving or that when we turn a light bulb on or when we're reading a book, which is one of the examples that I use in my writing. And I think that the idea is that when we are willing to be vulnerable enough and ask for help, we're also saying, hey, you know what? I recognize that I couldn't have gotten here without the help of anybody else. And I want you to be able to recognize that too.
Now, one of the things that you have been such a leader in is the formalized structure of mutual aid, which is described as a pillar of every formalized community of care. So what is mutual aid and what separates it from conventional charity?
Sure. So the terminology that's often used to describe mutual aid is that it's based on solidarity and not charity. And the key difference is that, again, in charity, oftentimes it's a one-way kind of trend. It's very transactional and it's a one-way transaction, right? Mm-hmm, it's from a have to a have not, if you will. There's a gap that needs to be filled. Somebody's filling the gap. And there may be a middleman, if you will, here in the United States, obviously a 501c3, a nonprofit organization, et cetera, that kind of facilitates that and removes the connection point between the giver and the receiver. Mutual aid is very much about that solidarity piece, which is making people feel seen and heard, holding space with people, being able to create those safe spaces and safety nets. And again, going back to the premise and the notion that every single person in a community has something they need and every single person has something that they can offer. So, you know, even if I am financially able to accomplish something or purchase things and I have, you know, sort of my material needs fulfilled, as I mentioned earlier, I may be suffering from time poverty. And I may need help from my community to be able to step in and help provide me with some space and some time. And And so I gave an example in the book of like when I was a single mother and the fact that I was very much, you know, both sleep deprived, time deprived, and, you know, working really hard to make ends meet. And I had to lean on community and ask for help from friends, people who were acquaintances, not even, you know, that I considered them a friend, if you will, at that time, but even acquaintances, to make sure that I had the time to be able to take care of myself, you know, right. And that came in the form of every Wednesday I had a friend that would bring over, you know, a meal so that I didn't have to worry about cooking mm-hmm. on that evening. That saved me time. That gave me back some time. Somebody willing to take my son to school a couple of times a week, which gave me time in the morning to be able to, again, administer self-care, take care of myself. And so when I was finally above, you know, water, my head was above water and I wasn't feeling like I was overwhelmed and drowning and teetering on burnout, I was able to then plug back into that community and offer what I could offer at that time to other people within that community.
Right. And as you point out in the book, in our society, it's such a rat race, you know, we're always pursuing more, more, more. And in chapter 11 is entitled, Enough is a Feast. And I love that. I don't know if you coined that, but that's really good. I also want to quote Lily Tomlin, which you put in your book, where she said, if you're in a rat race and you win, you're still a rat. I think that's hilarious.
She's so great. Yeah.
So great. You know, this She's whole brilliant. Idea about simplifying our life so that instead of like trying to accumulate endlessly and chasing that next hit of dopamine, as you put it, we can sort of like, you know, let go and let things circulate, you know, have a better quality of life. Yeah. That's really beautiful.
Absolutely.
Now, I love what you said. We keep reaching for that next hit of dopamine because we evolved to be anxious creatures who are always striving for more. That is an interesting anthropological insight that I think is very, very profound. And I want to thank you for that. And you point out how, well, here's a question. What is despair and how to resist it? I mean, despair is so tempting these days. It's very easy to say, hey, humanity sucks and the world's going to hell and it's too late. We can't, you know, correct climate catastrophe, et cetera. So how do we resist that? How do we resist despair?
You know, it's so interesting. So, you know, Paul, I don't know if you know this, but I live in Asheville, North Carolina half the year.
Oh,
we just went through Hurricane Helene.
Right.
And so, you know, so many people are still without homes and, you know, living in temporary housing or even tents, believe it or not. We were without water for 53 days. Many people lost their lives. And I bring this up just like because it's so recent in my memory, but also because, you know, when we think about moments of despair, moments where you feel like, you know, all is lost, in those moments, like out of the ashes, really such beauty also, you know, you see the worth of humanity, you see the worth of what we've done to the planet and to Mother Earth and like how it's, you know, coming back to kind of share just the distress that it's under with us. But you also, you know, you get to see the best of humanity in those moments as well, because all the helpers, all of the people that, themselves are struggling and going through that same moment with you, find their, you know, empathy and tap into that moment of vulnerability and are able to help and are willing to give you like the shirt off their back in those moments. So that whether you're in like a war zone or whether you're in a place that experienced a natural disaster or, you know, in this country. And so when you think about like all these moments, it's easy to fall into despair, but if you yourself commit to be, again, showing up and becoming the helper, you will find the other helpers too. They're out there, and that really infuses you with, you know, that hope that, well, wait a minute, actually there's a lot of beauty still left in the world.
So showing up is the solution to to or is the remedy for despair. We've only got another couple of minutes, and I want to give you a chance to explain how Pandemic of Love works.
Sure. Well, Pandemic of Love is actually, it's a grassroots mutual aid organization, which is international. It's in 21 countries with over 300 chapters and thousands of volunteers. And it's basically a way to connect people directly, people who have a need with people who are able to fulfill that need. And the need can be monetary. It could be something like, I need help paying my bill for my utility bill, my car bill, my phone bill, my rent this month. Or it could be somebody who needs help with groceries delivered or a lawn mowed or, you know, anything like that. And so the idea is that, you know, we created this portal, and it obviously was born through via the name Pandemic of Love during the COVID-19 pandemic, on the onset of it, to basically give people an opportunity to transact directly so that there's no middleman or organization involved. In other words, you don't have to donate to an organization, which then takes a fee and then funnels it directly to that person. But rather, it gave an opportunity for direct aid to happen, and more importantly, for connection to happen during a time, especially of disconnection.
I know that people can learn about this from your website, which I'm going to announce in a minute because we are out of time. But I want to close with a quote from your book where you say, from the Talmud, which is a Jewish scripture, when I was barely 13, this has been a guidepost for my work. Quote, do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Wow. That kind of sums it up. That sums up your whole activist philosophy. And thank you so much for being on the show and for being who you are and doing so much. It's unbelievable. And there's so much more we could explore. The book contains a lot of philosophy that we didn't even touch on, which is really beautifully put, about meditation, about, you know, self-care. It's just beautiful. And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, which is www.shellytogilsky.com. Now, that's all one word, Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-Y, last name T-Y-G-I-E-L-S-K-I.com. And for those who may have tuned into Pathways late today, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Intuitive Intelligence, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. Now, don't worry, you can play and or share this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Shelley Togelsky, author of Sit Down to Rise Up, How Radical Self-Care Can Change the World. I think this is a must-read book. I hope everybody listening to this orders a copy because it's amazing. And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed on the internet at www.kboo.fm every Sunday at 8:30 a.m. USA Pacific Time. And even better, podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, divination.com, as well as Paulo's YouTube channel and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Shelley Togelsky and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation. We'll be right back.
Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program.